Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The days are longer, the calendar's filling up, and I want to feel as good as this beautiful summer weather. That's why I've been loving Grunes. It's one daily pack of gummies that covers my greens, vitamins, minerals, and even has 6 grams of prebiotic fiber. So I don't need to juggle a complicated wellness routine on top of everything else. They taste amazing. They're easy to toss in my bag on the go. Plus, they're vegan, gluten-free, and HSA, FSA eligible for reimbursement. Save up to 52% off with code PODCAST at Grunes.co. That's code PODCAST at GRUNS. I feel like we've all been taught to be scared of the sun, avoid it, reapply constantly, cover up immediately. But recently, I started questioning that. The sun actually plays a role in things like your mood, sleep, and hormones. So I'm not avoiding it anymore. I'm just more intentional about what I put on my skin when I'm in it. A lot of conventional SPFs are filled with things like hormone-disrupting chemicals, seed oils, and synthetic ingredients. So I started looking for something simpler. That's what led me to Primally Pure's SPF. It's super minimal, only 9 ingredients, using non-nano zinc, plus really nourishing things like tallow and mango butter. I've been using their sun cream, and it honestly feels more like skincare than sunscreen. Lightweight, not chalky, and just easy to wear. So if you've been rethinking your sunscreen, Primally Pure is one of the best places to start.
Gotten to know Zach a little bit and think you have a fantastic, interesting perspective from a former GM's perspective. Figured to have you on here and have some fun talking about both these two teams. How are you, Zach?
I'm good. Thanks for having me,
Zach. All right, so you want to get into the hard stuff first?
Whatever you want to talk about.
Why did you trade Pete Crow Armstrong? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, he'd fit pretty well right now.
Yes, he would.
Nets, I'm sure people are not happy to hear me say that. But I grew up learning from people like Theo Epstein, Dave Dombrowski, you know, future Hall of Fame executives, that you kind of figure out who are your core prospects that you think are going to be huge parts of your kind of future, your next great team that you want to build. Everyone wants to build a sustainable winner. And you know, obviously, incorrectly, he wasn't one of those guys at the time. And a lot of the guys that were are guys that are in the big leagues now. And some of them have disappointed. Some of them have been okay. But, yeah, we had him, and quite honestly, so did the industry, had him probably as, like, our 5th, 6th, 7th best prospect at the time. And what wasn't a deep system. It's fairly top-heavy with Alvarez being number one at the time.
And this is your first year there, right?
This is 2021. Yeah, okay, right. I came on first as assistant GM and then slid into
the same year, right? And then yeah. Porter got in trouble. You slid up there.
Yeah, I slid into that seat. And Pete, you know, he had been the first-round pick the year before. Loved the defense, loved the speed. You know, we had some questions about the swing. The offense did not see this power coming. And I think that's the biggest thing that, and good for him, that's allowed him to go from, you know, not even being considered a top 100 prospect at that time, to then pretty quickly becoming, you know, a top 20 prospect in the game. And now you see, you know, 4 years after that, he's an all-star and having a great year, and he's a great all-around player. And the biggest thing is, you know, we thought he could be a solid big leaguer, like a high floor because of the defense, and you know, he's going to get an opportunity because of the defense and speed. Love the makeup too. This kid's great. He would have been great for this market. But, you know, didn't see the power there, so thought like that was someone that, you know, had a more limited upside than he actually did.
And did they want somebody else? Like, did you value holding on to the pitching prospects more so than even a center fielder, which I know is valuable in the game, but in accordance with a pitcher, what were the Cubs looking for in that particular deal?
Yeah, I mean, their focus was really on Matt Allen, and obviously in hindsight, that would have been the player that made more sense to move. At the time, you know, one of the tricky things about coming from the Red Sox to the Mets was just, you know, different perspectives. So at the Red Sox, you know, we didn't have high opinions on Pete Crow Armstrong or Matt Allen in the draft. So I kind of came into it with, like, not that they weren't good players, but just didn't think they were going to be impact players. So I wasn't too high on either one of them. The organization, obviously, they drafted them. People in the organization love those guys. But yeah, definitely Matt Allen was kind of the guy that people had significantly ahead. To me, I typically do like to prefer to trade pitchers because there's so much more injury risk. But sometimes that's how, you know, in Boston, we got into trouble by almost like undervaluing pitching prospects because they're so volatile. We were really good at developing position players, but struggled for a while. We wouldn't even draft pitchers until, you know, the fourth round. And so we weren't really producing a lot of pitching from internally. So I was going into my Mets experience thinking that and wanting to make sure we still had some good pitchers. And people loved Matt Allen. I mean, I think people were jokingly kind of saying, you know, you trade him, we're walking out here.
Wow.
Not really seriously, well, okay, but you know what I mean.
And then the other thing about that, not to belabor the point here, but it's an inside look here that I think is a great perspective that you can provide here. Outside of this year's trade deadline, the 2021 deadline, when you made that trade for Baez, that was the most aggressive that the Mets have been in the last several years, going out to getting Baez. How about the thought process behind new owner taking over, feeling pressure to try to win now and be aggressive ahead of that trade deadline?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it was Steve's first year as the owner. He, you know, came as his first press conference said, you know, we want to win a World Series in 3 to 5 years. I thought that we had a really good core of players. So it was more likely we were going to do that on the early end and more unknown on the back end of that 3 to 5 years. So, you know, we wanted to be aggressive. I think people forget we were actually in first place at the time,
yeah,
at the deadline before things really fell apart. We had a ton of injuries leading up to that. So there was, you know, we thought we'd get some guys back that we'd be able to continue. The division was just pretty weak at that point. It's pretty mediocre. The Braves didn't become the Braves until the second half of that. And be as good as they were for a few years. So, yeah, we thought we knew there were some flaws with the team, but we had a really good core of players. A lot of the offensive players underperformed. But we thought, you know, let's be aggressive. And Steve definitely wanted to be aggressive. And that's why we went out and got players that we thought would make an impact. And the players we got all performed very well. But obviously from things fell apart. DeGrom got hurt like immediately on trade deadline day.
Right.
You know, we didn't know the extent of it that day because he had been kind of in and out, walking off the mound a few times that year already. And so we weren't sure if it was serious or not. And so the timing's kind of tough because you got to make a call without knowing.
How impactful, BT and Sal, by the way, on the Fan, BT on Vacation, Zach Scott in studio, how impactful do you think that move was as far as the next year, where in 2022 the Mets had a much better team? You weren't there. I know Billy Epler was there, but it seemed like they were reserved. Maybe Cohen didn't want to part with the prospects as much. How much do you think was because of the Baez trade?
Probably. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, I wasn't there, and I have no knowledge. But it seemed that way from the outside looking in. It seemed like they were gun shy, right? Like you.
Well, was Cohen aggressive in 2021? Like, was he, or was he just sitting back, letting you guys go to work?
Well, he was letting us do the work, but you know, it was clear we wanted to be aggressive. You know, it's still my job in baseball operations. It's our job to, you know, make the right moves within that, you know, knowing that's the kind of the mandate. So, you know, he's not saying we should trade this guy or that guy. That's not the level of involvement. But it was clear, like, yeah, you know, we had made a small deal for Rich Hill, and it was pretty clear, like, we're not just trading for Rich Hill at the trade deadline. We're going to do something impactful.
Were you guys ever at that point thinking extension with DeGrom and or Alonso back when you were there in 2021? I know it's early on, like, yeah. Alonso was a rookie in 2019. Did that conversation ever come up?
So, not with Alonso. I mean, we did some internal work. We did internal work on everybody. Like, what does a Nimmo extension look like? What does, you know, but as far as conversations with the agent on the other side, we had a conversation with Conforto in spring training, made a significant offer to him. Very fortunate that they turned it down.
Yeah, dude, he turned it down.
I mean, he's a Scott Boras client. Scott rarely signs an extension before free agency. I think he wants to get guys to free agency, which usually benefits.
You wanted that, or was that more Alderson?
No, I actually came in really liking Michael. He performed really well for the previous couple of years. He was the right age. You know, he's, you know, good quality makeup person in the clubhouse. So,
yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino
and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law.
Yeah, I thought that made sense, but we knew our offer was not going to be. It wasn't like we made an offer to say we made an offer, but we knew, you know, how Scott operates, that this wasn't going to get it done. So, you know, in hindsight, he may end up making it up or close to it over time, just doing it with a bunch of different contracts. I don't know. He's had a tough go. He's been up and down, and obviously the health was an issue. So, you know, it was him. We were focused on him and Lindor, and obviously got the Lindor deal done. And then, you know, DeGrom, I did have a conversation with his agent. They actually made an offer to us for an extension, which was really not something we were considering. It was essentially what he ended up getting in free agency. So good for them for being able to get it. But given his age and some potential health concerns or some unknowns, at least we didn't really engage. Once we got that, we said, you know, I think I countered by saying, here's a concept of something we may consider, but it was just a big gap. So
where are you at with investing in starting pitching overall? We've seen it both aspects here with the Yankees going big on it, whether it's Cole, whether it's Fried, even Rodon, Stearns not going as big, looking more of a bargain there, trying to find some quality in lesser performers and being more cost effective. What would you recommend as a GM?
I mean, pitching's tough. I when you're dealing with free agents, they're usually 30 or older. And those guys, you know, they can fall off a cliff. You know, elite pitchers do age a little bit better typically, but that's partly because they're coming from a higher place, right? But so I typically like to do shorter deals with pitchers. That was a lot of what we tried to do in Boston some years. But we also went big. We went big on, you know, David Price there. And that is an example of one that we won the World Series, so you can say it worked out, and he was a big part of why we won the World Series in 2018. But the contract, when you look at it by itself, was obviously a bad long-term investment. And they mostly are. When we were working on the Price thing, my role was to lead the analytics group. We were doing some research on it and basically concluded that there's like a 30% chance that this is a fair deal. 70% chance that, you know, it's underwater.
So most of them are that anyway, but you still have to know that going in.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's the luxury you have as a big market team. You know, we did a John Lackey deal. It was pretty long with the Red Sox. At first it looked like a disaster. Then he had TJ, and then he came back and he was great for us and helped us win a World Series in 2013. So it's tough because you want impact pitchers. Ideally, you're developing them yourself or acquiring them via trade, like we did with Chris Sale, like the Red Sox just did with Garrett Crochet. I think that's the way to go, is to try to – you want guys in their 20s. I mean, that's – pitchers peak even earlier than position players because of the health concerns. So it's hard. But when you're a big market team, you can afford to take bigger gambles as long as the rest of your roster makes sense. So for example, David Price, that year we had a really young core of players with Mookie Betts and Jackie Bradley and Andrew Benintendi. And those guys were making, because of the structure of the first 6 years of the system, they're making a lot less than what they're producing. So you can balance out what you expect to be a significant overpay and an older free agent. You hope you get that impact up front, but you can balance that out because you have guys that are, you know, quote-unquote underpaid because of the way the system works. So you have Mookie Betts getting paid, you know, producing twice as much value or more than what he's getting paid. So you kind of have that balance. Where it gets risky, and I think the Yankees are kind of an example of this, is when you start paying multiple guys these big deals, and now you have a lot of guys in their 30s, and does it all kind of come to a head where you've just killed your flexibility? I mean, financial flexibility is a huge thing, even for big market teams, because big market teams just tend to spend more. So, you know, you're still limiting your flexibility, whatever your budget is. So having a bunch of guys that can't pitch for you because they're injured, because they're all, you know, 34 or at some point, that's highly risky, and they've done it a few times with some big long-term deals. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
BT and Sal in studio here with Zach Scott, former general manager of the Mets. One thing that I liked about you in your short time with the Mets is that I felt like you held guys accountable. You weren't afraid to say what was on your mind. Maybe there were some repercussions of that that we could get into, but you see the Yankees, like, for me, it's a culture issue, lack of accountability that probably starts from the top on down. What are you seeing from a GM perspective? What's going on with the Yankees?
Well, first of all, I have so much respect for Brian Cashman. I know from living around here the last 4 years, there's a lot of people that complain about Cash, but someone that's worked in the industry, to have the level of success, and I know in New York, if you don't win a World Series, it's kind of seen differently, but to never have a losing season, right? Like, I don't think he ever has.
No, they've been, yeah, on a sustained run.
And he's been there
like
almost 30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's unbelievable. So I think people that have been in roles like myself in the industry just have so much respect for Cash because of that's the hardest thing to do.
With that payroll, though?
Even with that payroll, because their advantage early on was much bigger, and now it's kind of
right.
It's shrunk because more teams have been able or have, for whatever reason, been investing more. So
right, but then they haven't had as much success as they did early on.
And that makes it harder because they didn't, as those teams started spending more, they didn't necessarily go up to some huge level to separate again like they used to be separated from the pack 20 years ago. So that's the first thing I'll say. But I will say, you know, one of the interesting observations since being out of the daily grind of baseball and doing, you know, being kind of in and out of it through consulting now, is observing the way the teams have carried themselves. And, you know, I think going back to when Cash had, I think it was the GM meetings where he kind of
went off on
the media and was
defending
dropping
his team.
F-bombs and things like that, which I loved. It was fun and entertaining, and it's good to see that sometimes. But, and he's one of the few guys that could do that. But I think ever since then, and some of the things, and I don't know Aaron Boone, I have a lot of respect for him, and I know people who love him, so, you know, I do think highly of him. But I will say some of the public rhetoric from these guys has been a little defensive, I guess is the word that comes to mind, or just kind of playing things off. And I'm sure that's more just outwardly and not necessarily representative of the conversations inwardly, but they're a little related. So as to your point, you know, the year I was there, Steve definitely, you know, he called the team out on Twitter at least once. You know, I did a little bit, and like you said, there were some repercussions. I probably said
players,
a little too much.
Players took issue with you, or was it upper management?
Well, no, players, because, you know, there was one time I was asked a question. We had so many injuries that year, and someone, I think, you know, the Mets history, there's a lot of bashing of trainers and medical staffs and their history. And a lot of the people that were there were really good at what they do, and they weren't the same people. So it seemed unfair to be taking shots at them. So when I was asked about the training staff, like, do you think this is a problem with them and not? And I said, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into injuries. And I listed trainers, strength and conditioning. I listed all these things. And when I said, you know, players also, you can set plans for players, but they got to stick to it. And I didn't mean that as our players are, you know, not doing what they're supposed to do. But at times, yeah, there are lapses in that. There's always been that. And every team I've been with, is not every guy follows everything perfectly. They have other people in their ear sometimes that aren't associated with the team telling them to do different things. And so there were a couple instances where guys, you know, we had a bunch of soft tissue injuries, a lot of dehydration that year. And it was like, those are preventable. So there was a little frustration that, yeah, that's part of it. It's like, guys, you got to show up for treatment. You got to get, you know, hit the massage table. If you're having these issues, you got to make sure you're hydrated. And some guys had some issues that year. So that was one of like 10 things I listed. As soon as I said it, I knew, well, that's the one thing people are going to jump on because it's about the players. Immediately after that media availability, I went down to the clubhouse to talk to Louis Rojas, who's the manager at the time, and said, hey, I need to get ahead of this because I'm sure some guys aren't going to be happy with it because however it gets relayed, this game of telephone, they may misinterpret what I meant. So I explained, we had a leadership group that we kind of picked guys that represented, you know, the bullpen, the rotation, the infield, a catcher, an outfielder. And I got that group together and just kind of explained, you know, why I said this and what I meant. And I just didn't want it to get twisted. And they were like, they had already known about it. That's how fast it traveled. from the time to go from the media room to the clubhouse. And I think it was good that we could kind of just clear the air. I'm sure some guys were still kind of annoyed because we weren't playing well. And that's what happens at the time is people are going to get a little sensitive and frustrated sometimes.
And I myself like the honesty from you there. All right.